Well, I thought probably I'd just be very brief, and then you can take your imagination thing to introduce them on. Well, I'll just be very brief on what I'm thinking about it, and then we'll start the main lectures. Pardon?
No,
talk to him about it. I hope he stays here because I want to involve him.
You're ready to go.
Very good. This is the informal beginning of our discussion in our September lay seminar. This year, I guess we really have two, in which we are, on the one hand, going to discuss Christian imagination, which is a continuation, really, of last year's lay seminar, which Carol and Mary will lead off, and Carol will take this in a few minutes. The other topic that we have been asked to discuss has to do with death. And we are doing this really at the request of Crossroads. Belgium and others have asked that Carol Hinderly and Fritz Norstedt, and they in turn asked me to help them a bit to discuss this subject, to bring it to the attention then of the readers of the Crossroads series. Now, the first question, there are many questions we can ask about death. I have been writing down some of these over the past number of months. The first question might be, why talk about death? Why talk about death at Holden, where gaiety is the order of the day and of the night, and even early morning? Why do we want to shut out the sunlight with the darkness of death? Each year at Holden, we do discuss many issues. At Holden, we discuss subjects of wide interest and application. I often discuss subjects which I refer to as having a high probability. I won't list these now, but they are great issues that we will face during our lifetime, and none of us can escape the subject of death. As George Bernard Shaw said, it's the ultimate statistic. And when I was thinking about this, Carol, I wondered, I think they've already picked out a title for it, but I thought a very appropriate subtitle would be Everybody Does It. Or Everybody's Doing It. Or another subtitle would be On Sting and Victory. And in this regard, I'm reminded of what appeared on the Jack Parr program when Robert Kennedy died. And Jack Parr, who was a very good friend of Robert Kennedy, quoted from Jacques Maritain, a favorite passage of Robert Kennedy's, which said, having given up God so as to be self-sufficient, man has lost track of his soul. He looks in vain for himself. He turns the universe upside down, trying to find himself. He finds masks, and behind the masks, death. And in commenting on this event, Jack Parr said, the worst thing about it all, I will never see him again. Now, we should have something to say to this. It will not be an easy discussion for many of you, nor will it be for me. It will probably even be more difficult than it was when I gave it on July about 26th. At 8:30 in the morning, I was scheduled to discuss death at 11. At 8:30 in the morning, Carol informed me that they just heard on the radio that my mother had died. And some of you have had those very close to you die very recently. I hope this will be helpful to you, and I think you can also be of help to us. Some of you probably have had certain days assigned to you. And to you I say, perhaps you're more fortunate than I. And as I used to tell my father, when he wished that death would come, I told him that he may, in fact, outlive me. He didn't, but it's a stranger that none of us can deny, and it probably brings up another question, which a list of which I have made. When will I die? And that's a very good question, and we have something to say to this, only from the standpoint of statistics. That we know that on lifespan of people, how it has changed, and perhaps if there is interest in this, I will discuss this. It is of interest to me. In our research, we do gerontological research on animals, so we can say something about this. We can, and I can go through a few of the questions that I have written down here, and maybe as we just make this introduction to this today, maybe you'll think of some others, you see, that you would like to discuss. What will I die from? Well, we have certain statistics on that. What is the, is death an active process? In other words, or is it just, you know, just a fading away? Well, there are very definite indications that it is an active process. I had a discussion just this last weekend with Dr. Dudley at the University of Washington, who's a psychiatrist. And he recalled for me that we really haven't studied the real dying process with an objective study, because it is difficult. And when we get to this thing, I think we should go into this. And he made some very interesting statements, just a couple that I will mention it if I can find it. And he engaged about 40 patients that had a chronic respiratory disease. And he had classified these, and then he sort of took the 40 of them that were classified as the most critical. And over a period of 4 years, 29 of them died. Now, they knew what the process was about. In other words, they were active cooperators. In other words, they too wanted to be involved here. And I'll tell you about that when we get to it. The only thing, and I should say too that so they cooperated in this, and when death seemed rather imminent, they met with the person, the psychiatrist, and discussed with him, with them, sort of their feelings. And the fear and trauma of dying were largely in the eyes of the beholder. And to the person that was dying, it was a relief. And this was generally the case. And so we will discuss that. You know, is dying an active process? And he has he's made some rather interesting studies on this, and it's one of the few studies ever done like this. So I think it has something to say to us. And then we should study, I think, this subject of grief. I mean, is it appropriate, for example, I think in the Christian tradition, to have sort of the 3 days of grief as sort of a policy which may be extended more. I mean, there are certain attitudes related to it. Or the 7 days of intense grief of the Jews. And we can discuss some of that. It does serve a useful purpose. And I don't want to, you know, get into this too deeply now, but there are books written on this. One of the ones I ran into that seems very interesting is Understanding Grief. But we must realize that this grief is a useful thing, but we must encourage the person, the bereaved, to get back into society, to be an active participant for his own good and for the good of those about him. I should also point out that intense grief, I mean extended, and our physician can explain more of this to you, but we know in studying statistics of certain diseases that these intense grief may be associated with a higher incidence in a group of people, say, it may help bring on, say, other conditions such as cancer and diabetes or certain mental disturbances. The chill of loneliness we can help with, and so our discussion here is hopefully directed as to how we face it ourselves and how we help these people. How we help these people in their intense grief. And the Bible has much to say about this. Now, maybe some of you have some other subjects. I mean, why can't we live forever? Why aren't we immortal? I mean, are there certain living beings or living things that are immortal? It might be interesting to you from a biological standpoint to discuss this. I can certainly go into this if this is your choice. How sharp is the sting of death? And on another issue, coming back to why talk about death? And I on another occasion have discussed this, and I'd like to just quote in closing on something that I have when I have addressed this subject previously. My initial reply really to such a question is that if you haven't got anything to say about death, you don't have anything to say about life either. Others have said it better. In Augustine's Confessions, he pled for a keener awareness of death, not because he wished to dull the thirst for life, but for precisely the opposite reason. To intensify the self-awareness for life. Seneca said, "No man enjoys the true taste of life, but he who is willing and ready to quit it." Tragically, however, today, the majority of people are like Miso, who is the central figure in Albert Camus' The Stranger, who said to the prison chaplain in about the only emotion that he really ever displayed when he was due to die, I have so little time left that I'm not going to waste it on God. And this is a tragic thing. And we who know the death of death have really something to say about this, a very great deal. And so in this series that we will discuss on these subjects, I hope that it will be meaningful to you. I hope that you will enter into the discussion for talking about its health. Perhaps we can play, if Norstedt doesn't come, his great testimony
with the death of his daughter, and his explanation of that in Vespers, I think will be a very helpful thing. And some of us will shed some tears. And you can cry unashamedly because, I mean, a lot of people say, well, why do you Christians grieve? I say that the Christians grieve because they love so much. So does anybody else have any questions they would like to address that we can put down?
I'd like to, if this will be appropriate, why is life prolonged so often by the...
That's a very good question. Yes. I have that down, and this is a very important issue. It's one that I was attending to address, and I'm glad you brought it up. This is a very important subject, and I myself am opposed to it, and I have already made known to my family. I mean, I don't want all these tubes. Huh? I don't want all these tubes. And they understand this, and my son understands it. And we'll get into some of this, because Dr. Dudley, I mean, he discusses this, and there's going to be conflict on this. The other thing I wish to address, and we probably should address this early in the session, is what is death? I mean, what is death by definition? And this is a hard, I mean, we're arguing about it today. I mean, really, what is death?
Even biologically.
That's biologically speaking.
Biologically speaking, when is a man dead? This is your question.
It really relates to that.
Because ours is a peculiar perishing age. It doesn't let you live and it won't let you die.
A very good point.
I would like to hear you discuss the current state of knowledge with the aging process.
All right, I'd be very happy to discuss that. Yes, it's an area of my of some of my research, and I'll be very pleased to discuss this sometime during this week.
Yes. And the corollary to the question I have asked, I've often wondered about the attained lifespan of some of these Old Testament characters. Are those actual years? Has there been any evidence, or is that just tradition that has crept into the good book?
Oh, I'll let the theologians discuss that. Really, as one looks at the aging, I mean, the Bible does speak, excuse me, of 70 and 10. And we really haven't done much for that.
And others,
I know. They speak of Methuselah and all. And I am... The oldest person that we, I mean, I don't know, that is up probably around 120 verified.
There's one question that I've never heard discussed, and yet it's something that we confess and speak of quite frequently, and that is with the fallen man being sin, sickness, and death. In other words, the question of the relationship between the sin that is ours and the consequent death.
We'll take time with that as part of our Vespers. I have planned a talk on Romans here where Paul specifically speaks to this, and where if you're going to read Paul without imagination, without his own concept of imagery, you're going to misread him and certainly use him, I think, falsely against other known facts. We know that before man appeared on this earth, whole species have already died. You know, this is one thing we do know. Paul didn't know it, we do. And for us to be false to information that we have is not fair. And it's interesting to take Paul's concept of death, which I will a little bit later here, when Leo's through even, and deal with it here, because here's where the Christian church grapples with the problem, not simply at the biological level, but in this death relationship, that a man is dead while he still has all the appearances of living, that we have painted corpses. This is what this little deal did for us last night, this girl who was jiggling around, and he just made her a malted milkshaker. That's all that was there. He lifted up her head, and this other one, he lifted up her head and he yelled down, "Anybody there?" You know, and she was just... Her mouth was still moving, but that's all that was moving in her. The brain had frozen years before. What is death from a scriptural point of view? And this is, I think, will be one of our real things we want to grapple with this week, because this is the area of the demonic. This is, again, the emptiness, the futility, the boredom, the death. Like, I have one little comment here from George MacDonald. Very perceptive, I think. All that is not God is death. All that is not God is death.
Well, he says that he, so what if the religion and the time and the time that it comes, he said, what more beautiful thing could it be?
Yes.
And I can see that the last year has been, the king came in, so this world was supposed to have been paradise in the beginning. God made paradise, it was really good.
There's a sense in which death can be then like fulfillment, but there's also a sense in which it's an intruder, and like it robs us of that which it remains, doesn't it? I mean, my loved ones have all been taken in the midst of their robustness. I was 11 when my father died. I was in my 40s, early 40s, when my sister died. She was younger than I. Those deaths are hard to accept, aren't they? Death on the battlefield, death on the highway, sudden death. The various shapes and forms death takes has a lot to do with the way grief responds to them too.
And of course, and Jesus, I mean, he wept, didn't he? I mean, he wept unashamedly on the death of his friends. And you bring up another point that it's one of the other questions I had. What is heaven like? Do we enter it here if you define heaven as to be with God? And my wife and I have had some intensive discussions on this subject. And we had a real controversy in our church. I wanted to start something. I'm sorry, last Sunday they were supposed to continue it on this subject of heaven, and there were diverse views on it, you see. I mean, is it to be with God? And we know that some places in Scripture, isn't it? New English translates it different. I mean, was the baptism from heaven or was it from man? Huh? And it changes it. Was it from God or from man? I mean, isn't it used sometimes interchangeably, God and heaven? So I mean, that might be kind of interesting too. I'd like to especially hear the theologians on it, you see, as to what heaven is like. Eternity starts here. Now you better change. Did you have something you want to say on that, or do you want to go into imagination?
No, I'll be taking transition from the one to the other because I think they belong.
All right, so even so that, and then they can take off on the crossroads what they want. Now, I won't believe in this. I really want to hear it. I'll play back. I'm glad you got it on because I want to hear that. I have to go over and discuss with the Missouri Synod the film.
Well, it's a new publications venture of the Missouri Synod to compete with the Fortress, I think, which is also an excellent one for laymen. And they discover in examining the literature at this moment that really there's nothing adequate for the disciple of the 20th century in this area of death, and where the proclamation of Christ confronts this issue for us in a real way. I mean, there's so much that, like I say, we know ain't so. I mean, sin into the world and death through sin. Well, long before man got on the world, death was around. And the whole species are extinct before man is even walking on the earth. You know, this is one thing you know, and I know, and we all know. It's one of those known facts that we have from the geological levels that we live in. And we speak of the sort of antediluvian period, the pre-flood era, where we have these fantastic accounts of men living to ripe old ages, in which age span evidently much less than what we enjoy today was there. Now, to what extent this is verifiable can be said to have something of any kind of future hope aspect for us while still on this earth, even as over against what science may yet do with the living room we've got now, I don't know. I mean, we're just left here in the realm of purely the speculatory. I really don't know. I do know what the scripture says, and that is that God limited man to this area where death confronts him, that in the stage of 70, no man can escape his own death, even though, like Freud said, no man dreams it. Not even in your dream life does it appear that you die, and I firmly believe no man really believes, in any sense of the imagination now being in belief, that he's going to die. We all actually believe it's going to happen to somebody else, but not me. No, this is, I think, basic to us all. The child thinks about his parents dying with a real sense of grief, no, and fright even, but that he's going to die doesn't occur to the child, you know. It always happens to someone else, not me. And I think this is basic to our thinking about it. This is the shock that comes to us when we realize it's you. Luther used this as really his prime leverage in getting people to hear the gospel, was that you've got to do your own dying. You better do your own believing. As no man can do your dying for you, no man can do your believing for you. Well, this confronted with death is what Fritz brought out in that very beautiful little Vesper talk on his daughter, that when she told her father and her husband, get out and come back when you've confronted your own death. I don't want you here until you have. The reason why my death is disturbing you is because it's your death that's disturbing. I'm not disturbed by my death. I have met it. You go meet yours and then come back. But I think in a very real way, this is necessary for us in order to encounter one another as human beings. Otherwise, we're posing. There's a pose, as Camus brings out in this little quote from The Stranger, where Leo has already brought it out, that he's no time for God now. You know, his death has been all that he's known. His whole life has been a death. And the possibility of any life is simply a kind of myth to be introduced at the end, which he doesn't accept. I remember as a boy of about 4, and I can date it rather specifically, my father came home very distressed. He was a pastor, and there was a young man dying in his parish that he tried to reach. And this young man had said, I've lived like a dog, I'm going to die like a dog. And he couldn't get through to him. And this had really upset my father, and I can remember how upset he was still as a young boy, a man who simply took death as something, his life is nothing and his death is nothing. Well, this is the spirit of Camus, you know, that Camus, that this is all you've got. And since that's it, okay, this is the average person, but he uses it to try to shock us into something more. His books are really sermons, and our century is a century absorbed by death. We have been a century to inflict death on more people than have lived up to a certain point in our history on this earth. More people have died by our violence to one another in this century than have even lived over a long span of time on this earth as we know it. So we are creatures of death, and there are those who believe very firmly that we are consumed even by a death wish, that our atomic bombs are part of this death wish. And they're not all of them Christian men by any means who'd have this insight from scripture. They have this insight from depth psychology that the death wish is basic to people, and that there's this sort of mass suicide that we see even in non-human species on this earth, where you actually have the lemmings, for example, in a kind of mass suicide. Evidently, overpopulation gets too much. There's no living room left. There's no privacy left. And they just simply go all off on a grand spree to the sea, where they all jump in the ocean and drown. They sort of mass suicide. It's one of those possible explanations that there's even a death wish below the human level in the animal. Well, these things are there. Well, I don't think there's... You don't know what they are. This is right. But it's still there as a mystery to be explained as a possibility. This is what they've explained as a possibility. I don't know. I think human beings require space to live, and I have a hunch animals do too. And when the space is too small, that's one of the possibilities. I don't think there's any question but in our reasoning at this moment, in the mass mind of man dwelling on this earth, that he thinks one resolution to the overpopulation problem is war. That the atomic bomb can solve for us what we can't solve, perhaps, and create more living room again. I mean, there's just this possibility of this death wish operative. I certainly believe that it's operative in man because I know it in myself. And I would suspect you know it in yourself. I would doubt any man's honesty with his own inner life who has not fought something of this suicidal desire in himself. Some of us have more of it than others. It's true. My first analysis from a friend who was being interested in a particular temperament analysis system at the time and who's a very perceptive person, the only genius I know, when I finished this little test he gave, he looked at me and says, why haven't you killed yourself before this? You know, I mean, as he went down through this, the sensitivities that are built into me, the kind of resentment built into me. I watched my father die all my life. He died when I was 11, finally. He died by parts from leukemia. To say that there's no hostility in my system against that kind of a universe that doesn't just kill people off decently. We talk about Dachau and Buchenwald. They're merciful compared to the way a lot of people die. That was a mercy death. Just taking a gas chamber. I mean, you've seen people die from which that would be very much a relief if that could happen to them, haven't you, doctor? And what doctor hasn't? And this is part of the human picture to which we respond. And there are times when it does seem too much for us. And the Psalms, for me, are very honest here. They cry out, you know.
Well, I think there's a difference between a death wish when somebody's already ill or having problems, and a statement that everybody, no matter how...
You say having problems. I say that the human race has a problem, and its problem is life. I say that the human race has a problem, its problem is existence, and that it doesn't know what to do with it, and it's too much for us. And that apart from God, there is a deep-going death wish that is exactly what man is. This is what I claim. And I say that's what every man, he's in death, and he has to come alive. He's wishing his own death until he claims the life that is Jesus Christ, who says, I am the life. And I believe this is his claim to absoluteness that he is. I think apart from Jesus Christ, man doesn't have a life, and we see it now. I'll exemplify it just in the case history in terms of our relationship now to the issue at hand for today, which is the culture we share. The culture we share, according to Scripture, is a perishing age. In this culture in which we live, there is no real, a real option for man to come alive. He can extend his existence by writing a book beyond his death that might live a little, or paint a painting. Having a child gives you a little biological extension, but it has no real ultimate satisfaction, because when you're dead, you're dead. And it doesn't matter how many people have their name on your lips, whether you're as well known as Lincoln is to the English-speaking world, or whether you are simply a nameless nobody with nothing even on your tombstone. You're dead. And as the proverb said, a live dog is better than a dead lion, you see? The way the old proverbs put it, you see? And we all know this sense of just existence itself. There's something precious here, and yet there's something that threatens us continually in our existence, too, that makes some people look to death. And other religions have made something of it. Christianity says that death is an intruder. It's not a relief. It's an enemy. And the last enemy is death. And it's an enemy still not overwhelmed. It's an enemy that may have been bruised, the sting gone, but it's there. Leo used this little bit here at the end on grief, and grief and death come close in our understanding of it here. A doctor's been here this summer earlier, Jim Nessie, who gave us our boat, asked me one time, why it is that Christians seem to grieve more than non-Christians? And he was a little put off by this. Now he's the one who shares the faith, but he was disgusted that in his practice sometimes for Christians, grief was a real problem, and post, you know, the post-death grief can extend for some while. And I said, well, Jim, that should come to you easily, because they love. This is a real person they've lost. I said, how many people do you know that are living together that can hardly wait until the other one dies? I said, you're a doctor, and you know that you're serving a lot of people whose even physical ailments are caused because of their impatience for the death of the other one. It's a relief when they're rid of him. They collect the pension. They don't have to live with it.
A Christian Science belief then?
I think it's so much hocus pocus, frankly. Christian Science belief that death isn't real. I mean, death is real. It's an intruder. We know it. And I think you have to deal with the world you're living in. I think of Christian Science as being a kind of formulated basis of what I called our Peter Pans this summer. We had a little group of youth in our village this summer for whom there was no evil, this was a good world, everyone was nice, and they played little games with each other. One day they were all frogs, and you had to pretend you were a frog to be able to talk to them. Another day they were birds, you had to be a bird to talk to them, you know. But the real world wasn't there, you know. It was, and of course, the only way they could escape then was by their pot, you know. And this is their, they had to turn to this. When the real world intruded on them, they had to get away from it with their drugs.
Do you think our attitude toward death would be different
if we could erase
the suffering period that went with it? Or do you think that this is the part that we fear more than anything else? Not the
transition,
this is the pass from one to the other without any degree of suffering.
Well, doesn't Hamlet answer that for you in his big soliloquy, though? I mean, there's more than that. If I could with this bare bodkin, you know, he said, okay, that's a sudden death. Suicide would be the natural answer if that were so.
But there's still a period of suffering, no matter where you. There are very few people that can make the transition without a degree of suffering. And this is the part that we don't like to think about.
Well, bullet wound or some drugs today certainly can take you out of this existence quickly.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, a person who doesn't resort to that, the suffering angle, it seems to me, is the
well, I don't know, because my definition of suffering would be a little different than from yours. In prison camp, as I used to say something, pain comes to everybody, but that isn't suffering. Suffering is what you accept and take on yourself. Suffering is what love alone knows. And this is another thing. And a person who's learned to love, pain isn't that primary for him. You know, it really isn't. You're that much involved. Even on the deathbed of very great pain, you have seen people who really have learned to love, living in the existence of those around them, with their concerns for them, that free them from that pain, and they're very concerned. They're more concerned about a son who's all mixed up, about a neighbor who's having a mess with his marriage. And we all know people in pain like this. These were the people in my ministry refreshed me for my pulpit. Their pain was an altar of an offering to God, of a kind of praise in the midst of their pain. That even this, they could still be used in their intercession, in their love for the other, couldn't they? So their world was bigger. They were alive. You see, they were really alive, and these people around them, in whom they were really living, and who gave them a surcease from that pain. My own feeling about pain, is, as I know it, is that it does offer its own anodyne. I mean, when pain becomes so intense, at least the pain that I have known and in prison camp and so on amongst those who have known, it does offer a kind of drug in itself. But for suffering, you don't have a way out. This is something you take on yourself, don't you? And this is where I think death and life in the scripture come in, where love is joined so that your world becomes God's world. And your suffering is his suffering in it. Now you're praying. Now your imagination has become peopled in the life of other people. Now, not only is your world bigger than your pain or simply that of a superego, your families or your countries, but it suddenly becomes joined and linked to the human race, doesn't it? Yes, this is right. And this yeah, well, I think this is the only solution, you see.
Can I comment on that? Yeah. I think the expression that you hear very frequently, what a good way to say.
Yeah.
And they speak to people who die suddenly, without pain, without suffering. That happens very quickly.
Yeah.
For example, there are many people who die, like that, yeah, in their initial first coronary occlusion effect.
Yeah.
They never know what affects them. They never have pain. Yeah. Accidental deaths are sudden and continuous. Many of them, there's no suffering connected to many of them. And that expression, I thought, a good way to die, though, is a lot of people.
Because you resist this, don't you? We're human. We should have an opportunity to respond to this event. There should have been some opportunity for anticipation. So the old prayers of the church say, and from a sudden death. You know, the old prayers of the church include this. And I thought a lot about this year in terms of a blessed death, and I'm going to talk on that this week a little later.
May I add this little thought? One time in a cryptic illness and surgery, the very first card I received was from a very dear Catholic friend, and it left a deep impression. And on this, I opened it, and I can hardly read it, and she said, "You are suffering today, but don't forget, Jesus suffered far more than you ever could possibly suffer." And I thought it was a terrific help to me.
Because you see, his is that of a love which takes it on.
The love,
isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a love which takes it on. This is right, and he learned by what he suffered, even for him, in the same way. We've got an argument on this, incidentally, this summer, because it is possible that suffering can produce bitterness, as we know. It doesn't always produce saints. It can produce rascals. And this is, it's the response to it, isn't it, that is so all-important here. And this is why I love Kierkegaard at this point, where he has a great sermon, really, on have you taken it from his hand? He says, "I don't say that your story isn't true." And he speaks of the most intense kinds of suffering. Because one thing I think, when we deal with this problem at all, we are aware of. What comes to us in the processes of nature, all of us find strength to bear. Even some of the most cowardly and weak amongst us. But what comes to us from one another is the roughest. And comes to us from those we've trusted and in whom we've placed our life, really, is the toughest of all, isn't it? Like good earth. They take famine, they take war, they take a little child that's a retarded child. They get all the sufferings that come, and all this they take and bear. But then he takes a second wife. And that's the suffering she can't take. That's what breaks her. This that we cause each other, isn't it? This is the toughest of all. And this is again where we see something here again, I think, in this whole relationship of life that opens up, that is no longer dead when it's involved with one another. We are literally dead in the scripture when we live unto ourselves, when our life is no bigger than me and mine, when my area of concern it reaches my grandchildren, perhaps, but that's about it. But I haven't been linked to the human race. I don't know the kingdom where we have brothers and sisters underfold. It's when we enter into this new area of life where we actually are when present to us, not as a matter now of judgment or condemnation, but of concern and real longing, is the emptiness and the boredom that afflicts today's youth, for example. We say, well, we've given you everything. Well, if you underline thing, I suppose it's right. You see, there isn't much in the way of things they couldn't ask for. They don't have to use their legs anymore, and many of them have lost the use of them. They've got cars to take them 2 blocks, you know, and so on. If they've got a car, they've got a moped at least, you know. We've given them everything, but we've taken from them something too. In this relationship of person to person and what it means to be a community, what the village itself expresses to our society, because we are this, a community together. And suddenly we come in, we get near enough to each other. We know each other by name. We know each other intimately enough so we're not scared to share things that we ordinarily don't. We let people take a little peek into our secrecy. You know, we get nearer to one another. For how many young people can this happen today? You know where it is happening in our society. Under the influence of drugs and the hippie movement, you see? But in the Church of Jesus Christ today, this isn't what you think of first and foremost when you think of the church. Today, the image of the church for our society is somebody's talking and a bunch of people are listening, and that's it. And you take up a collection, which goes for something, you know. And this is it. But a relationship, a new community, an awareness of the times that we share, of the pathos, the real burden of existence for the average person. Now, I don't think Ed lives in a death wish, but I think that 9 out of 10 men do. I think what saved Ed from him is because he knows Christ the life. But I think it's true for Ed as it is for me. That we live so close into him and to his tribe or his people that we tend to forget this whole vast world in which we live that's literally exploding under the burden of its existence and can't take it. And this irks me about myself. I mean, I've said about Mary and myself so oftentimes. One reason why we haven't been more creative and put down into print perhaps for others to enjoy and so on is that we've lived so close to our tribe to our Norwegians and so on. We haven't even seen the Swedes in our trouble. And the Swedes did the same thing. We weren't a church, we were a tribe, because the church is the whole of this humanity and its lostness and its suffering. And this is where we are brought in when we die, to come alive. Finally, this happens to us. And then our intercession becomes joined to Christ's intercession. And the peculiar thing is, I used to tell the kids in the youth movement, when this happens to you, when this mystery of becoming a branch on the vine takes place, so you enter into his sufferings over this world, when you're angry because people are going to bed hungry, as kids are angry today, and they aren't marching 25 or 26 miles just to pick up the few dollars they get from somebody for. They're marching to kick us in the shins on us. Nobody in this world's got a right to go to sleep hungry, they're telling us, see? And this is one way for them to say it, and they're feeling it. When you start to live in a world larger than you are, so what happens to the Indian and the black is just as much a sense of pain to you as what didn't happen to the Norwegian in this society. You see? Then you're coming alive. Then Christ is becoming real. Then life is becoming real so that you're with it. And then what Sammy Davis said the other night is true. That then you've got so much soul you don't have to die to go to heaven. See? This is just what he was saying. See? Then you got what you call soul. That's when the soul comes alive. Sin came, the soul dies. Now that Old Testament thing will always last. Nothing gets in the way. What makes the soul come alive? I often tell this little story because it really hits it. A bunch of pagans meet in Chicago who are all Canadian pilots in the World War I. But they were volunteers. They'd gone up before we got in and joined the Canadian Air Force. And every Christmas they had a reunion in Chicago. And they had a wild time. They got drunk and they painted the town red. And this was back in 1931. It was before the New Deal. It was right when the Depression was biting. And we didn't have any handout for the poor. We had Reconstruction Finance Corporation for the big banks that were in trouble. And that was it. But nobody else was getting any help. And one of the guys, as they got together, said, why do we throw all this money on a big bus tonight when people tonight aren't having a Christmas? He says, within sound of my voice around here in this old Gold Coast. He says, let's put all the money into a kit and go out and buy some fruit and some toys and stuff and go just house to house and hand it out. And he says, it took with us, and we did it. And we stuck a couple $100 a piece into the kitty. There's a whole bunch of us went out there, and he says, we went out 2x2 down there, and he says, it was something. He says, that night I really got drunk in a new way. And he says, the next morning I had a different kind of hangover. And he says, I realized this must be what Christianity was. He says, I hadn't any background. I didn't know anything about Sunday school. We had chaplains over there in the service. He didn't pay much attention to them. He says, but this must be what it was about. He got me reading my Bible, and he says, I went through all those begats till I got to where it said sin came and the soul died, and that was me. That was my trouble. I didn't have a soul. Well, this is just a barnstorming pilot talking to me when he picked me up hitchhiking once. Just talking, pointing out. But this you can see. See, he's come alive to this. This sense of it. He says, I went to a church. He says, one of those fellows Sunday morning, he shares the newspaper. I can read the newspaper without the preacher's help. He says, but I did sign a card in there that I was interested, so he pokes up in my garage. He says, I had all kinds of time to read the Bible. He says, I was going broke. He says, there wasn't any business, depression. So he says, there I sat, and the padre comes in. He says, one of those kind of ponderous padres, you know, a little stuffy. And so he says, I thought I'd puncture him a little. And he said, I suppose, padre, you interest me because you're interested in the souls of men. He says, yes, I'm interested in the souls of men. Well, then, padre, you got the wrong guy. I don't have a soul. And he says, he looked at me like I didn't have a brain either and walked out. But he says, I knew I had to get to this myself. And then he told a story of how he came to realize Christ was his soul. And then he came to this fact. He doesn't belong to the church. He's barnstorming around the country. He says, my problem still is my world's too small. He says, I know it's got as big, get as big as Jesus Christ. But this, you see, is what we mean by coming alive, by not being dead. He was dead and he came alive. And for these guys, it happened when there was a breakthrough because they threw away themselves in this gesture of generosity and something happened. I don't think anybody can really love in any instance, really love, even to love another beloved in the sense of love and not lust glorified, without something of the kingdom being smelt by them, without sensing that God is something better for us all than just living unto ourselves, which is death. And that's when we come alive. And that's why, for me, intercession and what we have at this moment is the key to the life or the death issue for us. Are we with this culture we're living? Are we aching over those who are outside us, the black? Who is, let's face it, not carrying just a chip, but he's sharpening his sword to go with it. Are we facing the kind of issues that we have in this old and young sort of a clash in our time? this generation gap, we call it. Because at the basis of it is the broken heart of God. That we aren't understanding, we aren't talking, we aren't seeing each other. Like that gal last night at that cocktail party just gabbing, you know. And we know the worth of a dollar and all this sort of thing, and she takes another cocktail, you know. And how many times haven't you heard it if they took another cocktail that had been in that same place? And they spend it on cars they don't need. They could get by with a much smaller one. They talk about spending and watching the dollar. Are they? Every time they get everything in one house that's so filled with pictures and stuff, you can't see the wall. They got to buy a bigger house to put them in. You know, that's the process. And or move out into the country finally. You know, get away from all this debris and dirt. Well, this is death, and this is death at work in our society. The culture we share, and what's wonderful today, I think, about the culture we share. Is at the points at which it's getting through. Here's a Kaiser Aluminum Company film. It rocks you. Nothing else gets you, certainly those little balls do, you know. Here's a film put out just by a couple guys in England, Bedazzled, we had 2 weeks ago. It gets to you. These guys are talking about evil, and they're letting it be shaped up in the devil, and you're seeing that the point is that until a fellow lays hold of God and all his mediocrity and says, I'll do it in my own mediocre way. I'm not going to do it with the daydream world. But with the kind of world I'm living. He isn't with it. He hasn't come alive. I think our culture has many things in it that are working for us, that are alive. But we do have, over it all, this great boredom, this heaviness of spirit, this living unto oneself. Dr. Vincent here has been a pastor, and he knows. He knows how hard you wrestle with these people who are the shut-in. You have those who are rich, who are living in a community. I give them a list of my confirmants, and I know they're being prayed for. And I say, now, some of these are really prayer orphans. They had a godparent when they were baptized, and it was just so much blasphemy. Godparent, godless parent. They've never been prayed for. And I'm going to have you praying for them, all through confirmation. But something may happen more than they learn a little bit out of a book or have a feeling of being bored to death on Saturday morning. You know, you get them with it. Their world gets bigger. Then they are complaining. Well, why haven't you been to see me lately? Nobody's been to see me lately. I'm just forgotten here. I'm all alone, so on. Talk about demonic. This is, you're hearing Satan speak. A world that's just as big as himself and no bigger. But you break through and let them come alive when we join in the intercession of Christ. And it is his privilege to let us do this. That we're permitted to share his intercession for this world. And something happens when we do. Kierkegaard, if I was going to quote earlier, since we were on the tape on death, and he's got something. He says, is there any man so dull that he hasn't this experience of dying at least every 6 months, of this ultimate finality, that someday I am going to be required of for what I've been and am? Well, certainly we all have times we walk on our graves. I have a terrible feeling of this every fall from Oldham Village. When the workers go, it's like part of my physical being wrenched out. These kids you've shared a summer with, they've made it. Their gaiety has been the healing of this place. They've loved it. They've given themselves unstintedly without complaint. They've worked overtime without ever calling it overtime. It was simply something to do, and they did it. And here we've been in the shared experience, and suddenly they're all pulling out of here. Boy, it's just like a bunch of people dying on you. You know, you just hurt, don't you? That's when I start walking my grave. And then I won't even remember who they are 2 years from now. You meet them, you see, and their face, and they've changed, and you try to put them together. Boy, we have this experience of continuous dying, don't we, in our own experiences. We grow older, and great moments that are just sort of blotted out. Well, I believe heaven is the restoration of all things. I believe these people are to be real to me there, and these experiences vital as we've shared. This is my faith, that heaven is a restoration. So what Scripture speaks is a restoration of all things, is that we are permitted once more to be joined to one another with an intimacy we never knew here, the kind that not even marriage permitted. That's your question.
About the congregation not moving, not caring enough about the members. Can I tell you a story of an experience we had about 2 weeks ago? Our congregation was a very fine family. Father, mother, and 3 children. The young boy was about 22. Had 23 years of college and then he began to minister. He was a very bright boy. He suffered from very severe headaches this summer, and the doctors decided that they would have to investigate his possibility of brain tumor, which they did about 2 weeks ago. At our church, we had a prayer vigil during the operation. And the people from the community were called in just by word of mouth. They knew about this family. And they said that our the agony was in the church. And the following Monday night, it was miles from the pulpit that there would be a prayer vigil for him that evening. The operation turned out was a malignancy, and everyone knew that. So the people passed this along from word of mouth, and we were very much surprised to find the church filled to capacity, and someone said it was more than an Easter service. There were people from all walks of life, all people from other denominations, Catholics came, and we spent a very informal hour, or less than an hour, individual prayers with this, silent prayers, the pastor gave a prayer, and I don't think the people in that congregation will ever forget that experience. Mm-hmm. Now, so you see,
that's living.
There's one.
That's living.
God may see it as good to protect the young man, we don't know. But those parents, those people in the congregation and the community will never forget that.